Students get a 10% discount on everything. Head out to the Quality Inn 10 a.m. to 8 p.m. on Thursday and Friday, and then on Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. for great deals on outerwear and sports apparel.
Queen's Homecoming kicks off today, and Welcome Home alumni. With a weekend full of exciting activities and events, there's something for everyone. Check out the full schedule and plan your perfect homecoming experience. Visit the Homecoming website now for all the details. Let's make it a weekend to remember. queensu.ca/alumni/homecoming. Partnership with the Kingston Music Office and supported by our friends at Modern City Taxi, we're pleased to present a selection from Hylia's new EP, The Piano Sessions, which was recorded with just one microphone and a grand piano. Local artist Hylia reimagines a collection of covers in her own unique style in this new release, and unlike her earlier recordings, the new release is stripped down and raw, capturing the intimacy and authenticity of her live solo performances. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visit kingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream The Piano Sessions by Hylia on your favorite platforms and enjoy a selection from it called Gold Dust Woman right now here on CFRC 101.9 FM.
Good morning. It is 11 a.m. on Friday, October 17th, and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. In today's episode, we'll be covering the crowning of the city's official birds, a few updates from City Council's last meeting, and a deep dive into a first-of-its-kind clinical trial taking place at Kingston Health Sciences Center Research Institute. After a tight race with over 1,600 votes cast, the city of Kingston has crowned not one, but two official city birds. The city invited residents to help choose the bird that best represents Kingston's spirit, part of its bid to become a Nature Canada certified bird-friendly city in 2025. A shortlist of 15 local species was chosen by the bird-friendly city team. However, keen-eyed Kingstonians noticed that one feathered resident was missing from the flock. Karen Santucci, Director of Public Works and Solid Waste with the city, described the eventful race.
We started this contest as part of an application we put in to become a bird-friendly city. So as one of the elements of that, it is to choose a city bird. So we started the contest. We have a bird team that we work with. And the bird team consists of a number of people from different organizations involved with birds and other similar types of things. So our team came up with a list of 15 birds. We chose from all different types, water birds, songbirds, shore birds, nocturnal birds, birds of prey. So we chose from some from every different area. And so we had 15. And then we had a huge outcry from the crow community. So in Kingston, there is a huge following of the crow community. So we added the crow.
Kingstonians flocked to the polls, and in the end, both the crow and the cardinal soared to the top, tying with 339 votes each. The pair will now share the perch as Kingston's official city birds.
It was a really tight race all the way through between the cardinal and the crow. It was hilarious to see. There was crow community was definitely involved. There was signs put up downtown, vote crow. And when it came down to it, it was 339 votes for the cardinal and 339 votes for the crow. So we've called them both the city bird. They're actually very interesting birds. They both stay all year. The crow is a very community-oriented birds, very intelligent birds. They flock together, especially in the winter. You'll see huge flocks of thousands of crows together. Cardinal's a little bit more of a solitary bird with just a few people in their community, but definitely, again, another bird that stays all year. So excellent birds to represent the city.
The winners were announced at the city's World Migratory Bird Day celebrations over the weekend. One more step in Kingston's journey towards becoming an officially bird-friendly city.
So we had two different events, one which was the Kingston Fall Birding Festival in Dougfleur Park, and the other one which was a hedgerow habitat workshop that was happening in the West End. Both of these were happening on the same day because it was Fall Migratory Bird Day. So this is the peak time where we see migratory birds heading south. So it is a global migratory bird day. So it was planned specifically around that event. The one for the hedgerows was sold out. They actually got a grant from birds from Bird Friendly Cities for that to supply some supplies for people to plant hedgerows. And then the Kingston Fall Birding Festival was downtown. There was a great turnout out there. I was there. Lots of people from Kingston Field Naturalists. Lots of people showed up from the community where people from Kingston Field Naturalists were letting them use some of their equipment, see the birds, explain what was there. Lots of kids, lots of older adults, lots of people new to Canada, new to Kingston. So it was a really neat mix of people. Everyone gathered. They were all quite excited to hear that there was two birds, the crow and the cardinal. So I think it went over really well. Everyone was quite happy to hear the combination of birds that had been chosen.
As the city continues to spread its wings in promoting bird conservation, residents can expect more initiatives taking flight, protecting and celebrating the birds that call Kingston home.
Yep. So in terms of Bird Friendly City, our application has gone in. Over the last 50 years, there's been a loss of about 3 billion birds. And so Bird Friendly Cities is a program to help reverse the trend through some coordination, some science-backed information and some local action. So it's really about what can we do to reduce the threats to birds? How do we protect and restore nature's natural habitats? How do we engage and communicate to communities? And how do we celebrate urban bird life? So taking a look at all of those, there's lots of different pieces that went into it. Our application was about 79-80 pages long. So lots of information that we have on terms of things that we're doing around birds, lots of things that we can still do to improve going forward. So we're trying to enter at an entry level. There's also an intermediate level and an advanced level. So lots of room for us to improve over the upcoming years as well. We've got a draft of a bird-friendly city webpage coming to the city's website. So hopefully up within the next month or so, people will be able to go in, learn more about bird-friendly cities, learn more about what they can do to help support bird habitats as well. So that will be coming, and there'll be some social media that goes out around that to let people know that that page is up and running, and there's information that all the residents could use from there.
And with such a strong community response, Kingston seems well on its way to earning its bird-friendly wings.
Lots of twists and turns along the way. We were watching it pretty closely. It was a fun race to watch on a daily basis. Excellent turnouts for this competition. So it was fun to see.
So with Halloween just around the corner, if you spot a flash of red or a full-on murder overhead, don't worry. It's just Kingston's newest celebrity species. At their last meeting, council received a mid-year update on the city's family physician recruitment program and a request to allocate an additional $400,000 to keep it going. When the recruitment initiative began in 2022, the number of patients without a family doctor in Kingston was holding stubbornly around 30,000, with residents spending hours lined up outside of clinics for a chance to secure care. In this latest update, the city shared that since the program's launch in 2022, a total of 33 new family physicians have been successfully recruited, and Kingston is nearing the milestone of rostering all unattached patients. Councillor Brandon Tozzo opened the discussion around the horseshoe, noting the refreshing sense of accomplishment, a sentiment echoed by Councillor Don Amos.
It's so rare we get a report that's great. And this is actually one of those examples of council and staff working together, allocating the appropriate funding, and us actually tackling and resolving the doctor shortage in the city of Kingston. It's impressive.
It was nice to see a positive outcome and report to value for money. And I think this is one of those health indicators for a city. And when a city can hit a home run like this and actually provide the amount of doctors with the patients that are needed, it works out really well.
Councillor Jimmy Hassan also noted the difference the program has made in what he's hearing from his constituents.
3 years ago, when I got elected as a councillor, that every third complaint we get or the comments we get, the email we get, it was no doctor, we need the doctors. But today, from last year and a half, I barely hear anything.
As for next steps, the program will be shifting focus to center on succession planning. Like many communities across Ontario, a significant number of Kingston's family doctors are nearing retirement. And without structured support for transitions, thousands of patients could become unattached once again. Over 28% of Kingston's 114 rostered family physicians are aged 60 or older, collectively caring for more than 22,000 patients. Craig Desjardins, director of the city's Office of Strategy, Innovation, and Partnerships, explained this next phase of the program before council.
We are actually starting to work in collaboration with the Physicians Council, the Primary Care Council, as well as going out and proactively meeting with the clinics to get a sense of when the doctors are retiring. So the goal over the next number of years is to make sure that we know before the patients have to be actually informed, so we would have somebody lined up ready to go.
According to Desjardins, the goal is to streamline the process so that when a doctor retires, their patients are automatically re-rostered with another provider. Desjardins also highlighted the crucial role nurse practitioners will continue to play in addressing the doctor shortage across the province.
The increase the number of nurse practitioners involved in the primary care is certainly quite exciting. There's significant change happening. In 2026, there's sort of a major change that will advance the billing opportunities for nurse practitioners, which will again change the opportunities for them. Right now, you're seeing nurse practitioner-led clinics. You're also seeing nurse practitioners better integrated into primary care clinics. So it is a really exciting time, and it is certainly something that is going to be critical for the Ontario Health System to address the challenge of unrostered patients.
Still, staff acknowledge the city's zero unattached residents goal won't come without challenges, especially as retirements continue and population growth outpaces recruitment.
We are working very hard you will recognize that it is a moving target as the city continues to grow and we add new residents to the community. Many of those, the majority of those, are not don't have family doctors. So that number is constantly ebbing and flowing. But I can say that with the four net new doctors that we signed just at the end of the summer, plus a innovation grant we issued that creates about 5,000 new positions. The Midtown Clinic is still rostering. They have about 5,000 patients to roster, I assume, as they move into their new location. And the OHT recently received funding from the province to roster another 3,500. So we have lots of capacity we're adding to adjust and meet the growing population.
Council unanimously approved the additional funding to sustain the momentum of the program. For those still without a family doctor, registering with Healthcare Connect remains the best way to get matched with a provider.
Every Kingstonian who live in Kingston, they deserve a family doctor. And we will continue to work hard to make sure that everyone has it.
Villarreal, get your act together.
That was Councillor Brandon Tozzo at Tuesday night's City Council meeting following an eventful few weeks for rail travel in southeastern Ontario. In September, to accommodate the launch of a new nonstop express train between Toronto and Montreal, Villarreal announced it would be reducing the number of trains stopping in Kingston and other municipalities along the corridor. However, the company postponed the planned service reduction shortly after the announcement. This all comes after changes announced in March to Villarreal's earlier high-frequency rail proposal, which originally included establishing Kingston as a regional hub. These changes were also formally opposed by council. Mayor Brian Patterson brought a motion to council on Tuesday night aimed at not only securing Kingston's current level of rail service, but also improving it. The motion includes three key requests to Villarreal. The first two are that Villarreal commit to maintaining existing passenger rail service levels in Kingston, and commit to a forward-thinking plan for enhanced passenger rail service in Kingston, including upgrades to the existing station and predictable, improved service into and out of Kingston. Mayor Patterson elaborated on the reasoning behind the motion.
The purpose of this motion is twofold. Number one, I think it's important that we continue to work to preserve the level of service we have. And so to be clear, VIA has made it as intending to still move ahead with these changes, just not at this point. So I don't think that we can shrink back and be complacent about this. But the second piece is that even with the status quo, I don't think that we should be satisfied with that status quo. And I think we've had those discussions around this table. I've heard many of you talk with the same passion and sometimes frustration that I have on this issue, because I see so much potential for what rail service could be to and from Kingston. I feel like there's a failure of imagination, a failure of an ambitious vision for rail service that I think would very much have the potential to transform a lot of travel through Eastern Ontario.
The motion is topped off with an action item, a request to investigate adding a late night train from Toronto.
And I think if we're talking about where we can improve service, let's start with a very tangible, practical example. I hear all of the time from people in this community about how they would love to take a train to Toronto to see a Jays game or a Leafs game or a show or even good dinner or even a late meeting, and you simply cannot do that. The last train that departs back for Kingston, you have to be at the station by about 6 p.m. or shortly after. So one of the things that I think that there is tremendous opportunity for is a late evening train back from Toronto. So here's a great opportunity where we can grow VIA's ridership, we can improve train travel. And so what we've agreed is that we will do our part in surveying the community and trying to get input about those who would be interested in late evening train.
Councillor Don Amos, who seconded the motion, didn't hold back his frustration with Villarreal's recent decisions.
At the end of the day, VIA needs to really evaluate their business model, because if you look at your fourth largest station and you decide to not provide more service there, how badly do they really want to be in the customer service business and moving people across the country?
The motion received unanimous support from council, and so did the feeling of confusion and exasperation over the company's shifting plans.
Like, what is Villarreal thinking? I have no idea tomorrow. Like, I'm going to just open up the news and just be like, what is Villarreal doing? Are they just bypassing Kingston? Are they shutting down service and going bankrupt? I think the chaos that this has brought on to the community cannot be understated, because people don't know what services we're going to get a week from now, 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now. Imagine what rail service could be in Eastern Ontario. We're living between three large cities, and it is becoming incredibly inefficient to take rail service. You know, I've had my frustrations in the past with Via Rail. I cannot think of a more of a time where I am more confused by the message an organization is setting out from a communications perspective to the community and to Eastern Ontario. I'm sorry I sound infuriated. This is one of those times where I'm actually really mad at a Crown Corporation, not the first time, but where I'm just like I have no prediction of what's going on in the future.
A copy of the motion has also been sent to other municipalities that will be impacted by service reductions along the Montreal-Toronto corridor, including Port Hope, Cobourg, Belleville, Napanee, Gananoque, Brockville, and Cornwall.
We do need allies in this. But I think that if we can join forces and have a collective voice on this issue, then we can finally shift the conversation from cutting service to where we can actually add and improve service.
Councillor Connie Glenn added she would be bringing the motion forward to the Ontario caucus to get other municipalities involved. For now, Kingston's rail future remains on the tracks, but uncertain, as council, commuters, and neighboring municipalities wait to see what Via Rail's long-term plans have in store. Homecoming celebrations have officially begun in Kingston as the city gets ready to welcome Queen's alumni and guests for a weekend of festivities across campus and downtown. The University District Safety Initiative is now in effect until November 2nd. This means there will be an increased bylaw and police presence in the University District. Fines under the nuisance party bylaw range from $100 to $2,000 depending on the offense, including noise, using closed roads, and hosting large unsanctioned gatherings. Breakwater Park and Gord Edgar Downey Pier will also be closed nightly from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m. through homecoming weekends. With construction still underway in parts of the district, drivers and pedestrians are asked to plan ahead and respect parking restrictions. You can find maps, event details, and safety information on the City of Kingston website or the Queen's University website. Have fun, stay safe, and welcome back, Gales. Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report for today featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is your Environment Canada weather report for the Kingston region. Friday, October 17th, 12 degrees, overnight low of 4, and then Saturday, October 18th, homecoming football game between the Queens Gaels and the Windsor Lancers. It's going to be 15 with a 56% chance of light precipitation at times, so a mix of sun and a little bit of rain clouds, otherwise a lovely day. Sunday, October 19th, daytime high of 17 degrees, 55% chance of rain, and then starting off next week, Monday, October 20th, daytime high of 16 degrees with a 57% chance of precipitation. This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. The LaSalle Causeway will be closed to all motorists and pedestrians on October 14th from 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. Please make alternative travel arrangements. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess 2 Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity at 484 Albert. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Berry Street, King Street West to Stewart is closed October 14th to 18th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. to accommodate ongoing construction projects. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto, closed for sewer separation. Johnson Street at Victoria closed until October 24th for sewer separation and road rehabilitation. Kings Court Ave, concession to First Ave, closed October 10th to November 21st for gas main installation. Queen Street, Wellington and King, westbound lanes will be closed October 14th to 17th from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. for the installation of new services. Ontario Street, Brock to Clarence is closed October 14th from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. to accommodate the removal of planters on Ontario Street. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen is closed until October 24th for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Tivoli Avenue closed at Midland and Sierra until October 17th for the installation of new services. Wellington Street, Queen to Berwick is closed October 14th to 17th from 7 to 7 for the installation of new services. Victoria Street, Union 2 Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of active transportation infrastructure. Catwoods Drive, Centennial to Gardeners, expect delays for the construction of a new multi-use pathway. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. John Marks Avenue and Innovation Drive, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to start work on John Marks Ave, Innovation Drive, and Discovery Avenue. Work includes curb, sidewalk, asphalt milling, and repaving. Lancaster Drive, Limestone to Jasper. Expect delays while a contractor completes construction of a new sidewalk and some road improvements. Montreal Street at John Counter. Expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage. Trudell Road, development to Danbury. Expect delays while a contractor completes road and sidewalk improvements. And Victoria Street and Earl Street. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalk, and road.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news.
For the first time ever, researchers are studying whether non-hallucinogenic doses of psilocybin, the active compound found in psychedelic mushrooms, could help to treat generalized anxiety disorder. The Kingston Health Sciences Center Research Institute is leading this first-of-its-kind Health Canada-approved Phase 2A clinical trial. The trial will be testing the daily, at-home use of microdose psilocybin to see if it can safely ease anxiety symptoms without the trip. Generalized anxiety disorder affects about 5% of Canadian adults, more than 1.6 million people. And while it's common, many existing treatments can be slow to work or cause side effects that make long-term use difficult. Principal investigator of the study, Dr. Claudio Suarez, sat down with CFRC to tell us more about this first-of-its-kind clinical trial and what it could mean for the future of anxiety treatment. To start us off, I was wondering if you'd like to just introduce yourself for our listeners.
Well, my name is Claudio Suarez. I'm a psychiatrist here at Queen's University. I'm professor of psychiatry at Queen's. I'm also a clinician who sees patients in the medical and surgical floors from psychiatry. I work also in oncology and palliative care. And I do research. I'm the director of the Center for Psychedelics Health and Research at Providence Care, and also doing research in psychedelics here at KGH.
Great, thank you. And getting into our topic today, I was wondering if you could start us off by speaking to the gaps and challenges in current treatments that have kind of led to us turning to exploring these alternative methods.
For sure. So as you know, we have a lot of people suffering from depression and anxiety, like more kind of a clinical disabling anxiety, like 1 out of 6 Canadians have anxiety. And not everybody do well, not everyone does well on medications, right? So we have psychotherapies that are quite effective for anxiety. But again, not everybody has access to psychotherapy and not everybody responded to psychotherapy. And the medications that we have are primarily antidepressants that we use for anxiety. Some patients responded well, but they can't tolerate side effects. They have, you know, weight gain or sexual dysfunction. So we're always looking for new treatments for anxiety to have another tool in our toolbox. And psychedelics are emerging as kind of promising treatments for anxiety. So that's why one of the things we're looking for is the use of a low dose or microdosing psychedelics, in this case, psilocybin for anxiety.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit to the background and evidence so far, just where we're at with psilocybin specifically.
Sure. So psilocybin is the active ingredient of the magic mushrooms, right? So they have been used in like recreationally, but also in ritual and religious ceremonies for many, many, many years. And probably over the last 10 or 15 years, we're kind of experiencing like a renaissance in research on psychedelics. People are rediscovering psychedelics as potential medical treatments and trying to apply what we know about psychedelics for many years into the medical setting. So we see a lot of studies happening in psychedelics, particularly psilocybin, for depression, anxiety, to reduce cravings for alcohol in patients who have alcohol use disorder, and for PTSD as well. Although PTSD is more MDMA, that has been studied for for that. But the psychedelics, Christina, in most studies, the predominant school of thoughts for psychedelics is to use what we call macrodoses, right? So people have a dose that induces changes in their perception of the environment, and perception of themselves. That's what we call the altered states of consciousness, or the trip. It's like people go through a hallucinogenic trip, which is it's an epiphenomenal. So there's a lot of things happening in your brain at the time that you do that. But that requires patients to come to a medical setting and use that medication and be under observation for at least 6 to 8 hours. So it's labor intensive. There are some more risks and side effects involved. The more recent school of thoughts were in parallel to that, we're looking at using psilocybins in lower doses that will not cause that whole experience of psychedelics from the hallucinogenic point of view, but will still have beneficial effects in your brain, maybe increasing neuroplasticity, maybe helping to reduce the ruminative thoughts or the, you know, constant worrying that you have and anxiety. And they seem to work well. So there are some promising studies, but they have not been tested in a more kind of a, I'll say, structured way. So that's the first study that we are aware of that's using microdosing delivered at home to be used at home for anxiety.
Mm-hmm. And again, you're talking about microdosing there and kind of getting into the nitty gritty. I was wondering if you could dive a bit deeper into what this means, either in practical or neurological terms, as opposed to, you know, going on a full macrodose and having those experiences.
For sure. So when we talk about macrodose or higher doses of psilocybins, usually we're talking about taking at least 25 or 30 milligrams of psilocybin, which then will induce that altered states of consciousness or, you know, what recreationally people call a trip, right? And that is probably the way or the mechanism by which psilocybin works in macrodoses. So it's a boost of effects at once that cause a cascade of reactions in your brain, increase neuroplasticity, and then opens that what we call more flexibility in your cognition to deal with anxiety. And that is done in combination with psychotherapy. So the notion is that you're using the macrodose to make it easier for patients to engage in psychotherapy and make it easier for them to be more cognitively flexible, to be more psychologically open to psychotherapy. When we're using microdosing, you're usually using a much lower dose. So it's between 1 to 3 milligrams. The sweet spot that we're trying to study is around 3 milligrams because it's just below the threshold for changing your brain from the hallucinogenic point of view. So at that dose, you're using the pharmacological effects of the psilocybin. So you're not inducing the hallucinogenic trips. You're not inducing changes in your perception. It's almost like using the same pathway that we use in antidepressants, but without having the side effects of the antidepressants. So the idea here is to use psilocybin more as a medicine as opposed to a catalyst for psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Because I think a lot of people, I think about psychedelic treatment as the experience of the trip is more so what's solving your issues or helping you work through it. But this sounds like it's more like those chemical changes in your brain, and that it's a bit different. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So, and that's, you know, what you mentioned before, the psychedelic experience make it easier for you to do psychotherapy. This is probably the predominant classic way of thinking about psychedelics. And probably, I want to say 80 to 90% of the research on psychedelics so far has been focused on that way of delivering psychedelics. But we also know that psychedelics are neuroplastogens. So they change the brain plasticity, and they also have effects through serotonin in your brain, the same chemical that we use in antidepressants. So it's interacting with the same receptors that we use in medications, for instance, for depression and anxiety. So what we're looking at here is to benefit from, you know, low doses or low dose of psilocybin delivered every day for a period of time, similar to what we do with other medications, but hopefully have a more enduring and less trouble from the side effect point of view that we have with antidepressants. So minimizing sexual dysfunction or weight gain or all the other side effects that sometimes are a major barrier for people to take medication for anxiety.
Mm-hmm. And getting into this clinical trial, what's that going to kind of look like and what makes it such a first in Canada?
So this is the first time that we're aware of that Health Canada has approved a study to allow us to give patients microdosing psilocybin to bring it home and take it home. So as you know, psilocybin is illegal. So you cannot or you should not go and buy psilocybin anywhere. So in order for you to do studies on psilocybin, we have to apply to a lot of the regulatory bodies, including Health Canada, to get permission to obtain the psilocybin and store the psilocybin. So that has been done for other studies as well. But this study in particular allow us to then have a protocol in which patients come and try psilocybin for the first time in our hospital. They stay here for a few hours. We make sure that they don't have any unusual responses to psilocybin. And then they can take the medication at home. So they go home with a 1 week's worth of medication, and then they can use the medication at home. We monitor that very closely. And then they come every week to be reassessed up to 4 weeks. So it's a 4 week trial. And then people who responded well can stay for another 4 weeks when we then randomize them to be either on placebo or to remain on psilocybin. So that we're going to be looking at if they have any withdrawal symptoms or rebound anxiety after using for 4 weeks. So the total study is 8 weeks, but the first 4 weeks, everybody knows you're taking medication. And then the next 4 weeks, we split them between placebo and medication.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, what kind of outcomes are you measuring?
Yeah, so this is a phase two trial. So the clinical trials have different phases. So phase one usually is what we're looking at if the new medication is toxic or trying to find the right spot, so to speak, on the dosing. So that's how we end up with a 3 milligram dosing for this study. So this is a phase two trial. Phase two trials are usually small trials, like less than 100 patients. When we're trying to look at primarily safety and tolerability. So we're looking at if patients have any side effects. We check their blood work to see if their, you know, kidneys are working well, their liver, their heart, to make sure that everything is okay prior to, but also make sure the medication doesn't impact their health in general. But we also collect some data on efficacy. So we look at scales for anxiety, measure their anxiety, their self-perception of anxiety, how well they are functioning at home or work or at school. So there are a few measures that we use to look at success. And that study will inform, hopefully, a phase three trials. For phase three are larger trials, more like what we see when we're applying for new medications to Health Canada or FDA. We have to use a phase three trial. So these are larger trials. But this trial that we're doing, we will inform the next one if everything goes well.
Mm-hmm. And I was just going to ask you, just as a clinician and as a scientist, what excites you about diving into this research?
Well, so when I got involved with psychedelic research probably close to 3 or 4 years ago, when Queen's decided to put together a advisory board to look at psychedelic medicine. And I came from the field on psychiatry, mood disorders, but also see patients in oncology. So I was aware of the major gaps that we have in the treatments that we have for depression, anxiety, but also PTSD and oncology. A lot of patients with late stage cancer have what we call existential distress, and that really doesn't respond well to medication. And psychedelics have emerged in the last few years as a promising option for many of those patients. But there are not a lot of clinical trials happening in Canada. And I became fascinated with some of the options. And I saw and I've seen, I did a long training in US, close to 1 year on psychedelic research. And I've seen both patients and participants, but also videos with dramatic changes very quickly. So I became quite fascinated by the promising effects, but also very aware that psychedelic research comes with a lot of stigma, a lot of mistrust and misinformation. So getting involved in research, but also helping to destigmatize psychedelics and find the right population that can use. It became one of the areas that I'm quite interested in. So we created a center for psychedelics at Providence Care. We opened last year, and we're doing research both at Providence Care, but also at KGH as well.
Mm-hmm. And what are you hoping this means for the future of care in this area?
So I think if we can learn when and how psychedelics can be helpful, that will inform probably in a better way how can we use psychedelics in the medical setting versus recreational, which is one of the challenges with cannabis, for instance. Right? When cannabis became legalized, the research on cannabis suffered because a lot of the medical cannabis research became very difficult to conduct studies because people just go across the street and buy what they think they're buying, right, in terms of concentration and use. So what we're trying to do is to avoid that we make some of the mistakes that we made with cannabis in general, that we understand how psychedelics can be used safely for medical purpose. So then if or when psychedelics become legalized, we can clearly differentiate what is psychedelic use for medical practice versus psychedelics for recreation.
Mm-hmm. And just to wrap us up here, who can take part in this study and how can people get involved or learn more?
Yeah, so people can reach out to us. So they can look at, you know, CS Research at queensu.ca, but they can also reach out to KGHC or the Center for Psychedelics at Providence Care. What we're looking for this particular study are anyone ages 18 to 60. Whose primary diagnosis is anxiety. Either they were diagnosed with anxiety by their GP or their primary care or psychiatrist, or they were medicated for anxiety in the past. And they're having right now anxiety that's really affecting their ability to function, like constant worries or concerns, inability to function due to anxiety. They cannot be suffering from major depression or psychosis or alcohol use disorder. But we will screen them. We will have an assessment. And if they qualify, they can come to the study. We do a series of medical assessments to make sure they are healthy otherwise. And then they can join the study.
Once again, that was Dr. Claudio Suarez, who will be leading a first-of-its-kind study on the use of psychedelics to treat generalized anxiety disorder at the Kingston Health Sciences Center Research Institute. As one of the largest mental health research trials currently underway at KHSC, the study represents an important step in advancing evidence-based innovation in psychiatric care. As Dr. Suarez mentioned, researchers are currently seeking adults living with generalized anxiety disorder to join the study. To learn more or inquire about participation, you can contact the research team by email at cs.research@queensu.ca. Just in time for Autism Acceptance Month this October, local author Julie Green has released her new book, Motherness, a deeply personal memoir detailing her experience as an autistic mother raising an autistic child. Green, diagnosed nearly a decade after her son, reflects on the challenges and insights of autism, from masking and feeling othered to empathy and belonging. Green sat down with CFRC to discuss this new release. So to start us off, I was wondering, for those who don't know you yet, if you could introduce yourself and maybe share a bit about your connection to Kingston.
Ooh, okay. So I'm a writer. I was born in Cornwall, Ontario, and lived in England for, a decade. Lived in Toronto for another decade. And then in the height of COVID, for some strange reason, we randomly decided to move to Kingston and have been here ever since. And we love it. So that's what, almost 5-6 years.
Now you're releasing Motherness. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to what inspired you to write it and why now was the right time to share this story.
Yeah, so it was a little bit strange. It took me, my son was diagnosed with autism at 3, and I didn't know a thing about it aside from what everyone seemed to know, which is Rain Man, which is not really a very grand stereotype. And it took me a lot of time to realize that I might be autistic as well, because my son and I, there were glaring similarities, but there were so many differences as well. And I became involved in writing about parenting, worked for a parenting site as a staff writer. And I got to know, just I think through the comments, an autistic woman who had an autistic child and thought, okay, the penny dropped. She and I were so very similar, and I started to learn how autism can look a little bit different in females, and sort of approached my GP about it. And honestly, she said, fine, I'll put you forward for an assessment because I know about your son, and I know you've had kind of a medical history with, you know, depression and anxiety, different things. And then I honestly forgot about it. And we moved to Kingston. And then I think I was on a wait list for about a year and suddenly got a call during the pandemic saying, you're having this assessment. So it was via Zoom, which was strange, with a panel of doctors. And then I don't know, maybe a month or so later, we had another meeting and they said, yes, you are. And here's like a 9-page report. So it was very, very strange process. They interviewed my mother. It was like about a half day, very grueling, lot of sort of tests and like a very comprehensive medical and just life history, if you will. And so what I think happens when something is pretty momentous, you've gone, I was 44. So you've gone all this time in your life thinking you are who you are, and it just paints everything in a different light. So I started looking back at all these different things that had happened in my life and going, oh, okay, well, with this new information, I'm looking at things a little bit differently. And then also kind of comparing with my son's experience, I was just writing through things because that's always been my way of processing things. And I think in doing that, I eventually realized, you know, this story is a little bit bigger than me. I think this is what happens with memoir. You have to weigh against this idea that's very, very unnerving and cringeworthy, sharing so much personal information. But when you realize a lot of other mothers and women out there potentially could see themselves. And basically I hadn't read any books like this. There seemed to be very few narratives. I mean, about autism generally, it's either a superpower and you're a savant, or it's the biggest tragedy and you're like a cross to bear for your parents. And there seemed to be no in between. And I hadn't really read anything about, there were starting to be a few books about autistic women, but not really in relation to being a mother as well. So I just felt like since I was exploring that maybe it would be good for other people to, you know, you write the book that you wish you had, I think. And that's pretty much what happened. It was a very roundabout way of getting there and a roundabout way of describing it now. But that's pretty much what happened. It was like a 10-year process of uncovering things, and then really only a year to write, and then 2 more years to wait for it to be published. But yeah, it's such a long, long thing. So I often joke, actually, that, you know, I could have probably given birth to 2 human babies in the time it takes to to publish one book. But you know, I'm happy it's out there now, and I'm already getting feedback that a lot of women, a lot of parents are really relating hard to it, and that makes kind of the discomfort worthwhile.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're going to dive into a lot of that. I have to circle back, but my first question was just that you've lived and written here in Kingston. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to how the local community shaped both your writing and the experiences that you've written about.
Well, the funny thing is, when I was first moving in Kingston, I actually got a little bit more involved in the visual art scene. I was, that's always been a passion of mine as well. So I was sort of dividing my time with a little bit of freelance writing. But actually, I was getting kind of involved in some of the local galleries here. I was with Martello and Frameworks, and just found that quite a nice community to get involved with. And actually haven't really got too involved in the writing scene here. Writing's such a, it's a very isolating thing, or it can be. I probably should try. It's hard to kind of break through that anxiety and connect with people through what's normally a very private experience. But now I'm having to do a lot of that. But no, initially my breakthrough in getting sort of settled in Kingston. Well, first there was the delay with the pandemic. We moved to this beautiful city and I remember how difficult it was because you'd look around all these amazing storefronts and all these shows. Well, you know, the Grand was there, all these places, the screening room, some of my favorite places now were just shuttered. And it was torture because we couldn't go in anywhere. So there was such a delay in just kind of being able to explore the city properly. So it took us a while for it to feel home, I think. But when I did start, it was actually through the visual arts community here instead where I started to connect with people.
Wow. Yeah. And also kind of on this local note, there's a lot of conversation about inclusivity and awareness, and we have a lot of great resources and community here. But where do you see progress locally, and where do you think we still have some work to do?
I think things are changing. I mean, I think there's obviously a lot really turning with females and like certain marginalized groups that were missed that are now being identified. So that accounts for why it seems like there are more neurodivergent people now. So there's definitely much more awareness. On a local level, we've had a very good relationship with my son's school that's developed over years. And it's been amazing because he's been able to be at the same place since middle school. And he's definitely had a lot more, being a smaller city than Toronto, he's had a lot more individualized support. And, you know, I've gotten to know like the same teachers, the same principal. So we've really been able to develop connections there to get that support. But even in terms of Queens, actually, my son did a mentorship program here. Two years. And he's extremely passionate. I write a lot about it, but his major passion is linguistics. And he was able to connect with a linguistics student here. And they would meet up every week and just chat. So it was nice to, it was a very cool community program. I think it was through Community Living in Kingston that set that up. And that was a very cool thing, initiative that Queens were involved in as well.
Awesome. I didn't know we had that. So that's really cool.
Yeah.
Kind of circling back to more the meat of the memoir. Sure. You speak a lot about being diagnosed later in life. And as a woman, I was wondering if you could just, speak to that and how you hope your story will help other adults who are maybe experiencing the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a clinician, so I can't, I mean, there's just so much more information now. I think from my understanding, the DSM, which is the diagnostic manual that contains all of these things, it's changed so much over the years. And it was very much the testing and the manual and everything and all the research that was done. I mean, this happens for a lot of medical research, not just autism, things that are autism related, but, you know, girls weren't included in the research. And I think hopefully with that changing and they will hopefully broaden even and adapt some of the main, think of something called the ADOS, which is the main measure. It's one test, one form that you fill in, a diagnostic test basically to see, but it leaves out a lot of the nuance in female presentation. Like masking is a very big part of, how autism presents in a lot of females. So I hope with time they're going to sort of evolve the whole diagnostic process. And I know some clinicians are much more aware of it now, but it takes a long time for these sort of things to catch up and change. So I see it changing. It's just, the scientific community. I mean, there are studies, things are happening now, and we're just waiting for maybe the next edition or version of the DSM will include masking and will include sort of a wider presentation so that maybe it will be easier to identify girls so they won't have to wait till they're 44 to realize, that they are autistic and rather than internalize, things as being personality flaws or, you know, what's wrong with me? Why can't I do that? Why am I like this? They'll actually have a better understanding for their neurotype rather than attributing it to like a personality flaw or personality defect.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned you've already been getting some feedback from readers. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to that. What have you been hearing?
Yeah, it's a little bit surreal. Like, I think one person said, oh, it's as if she like went inside my brain and, I don't know, very, very touching things, which is still, I don't know. I can't quite wrap my head around it yet because writing is such a private thing. And I mean, obviously I had a publisher, I've been waiting, you know, to get it published. So, but I think there's this disconnect where it doesn't feel quite real that people out there in the world are suddenly going to be reading about these experiences you've had. I don't know why there's that disconnect, but it's finally occurring to me now that, oh, okay. Suddenly all these people will know these things about you in your life. Which is fine. That's the decision I've made, but it also is a little bit strange. And I mean, memoir is a weird beast. Like there's so much people might assume, oh, they suddenly know everything about you, but it's very sculpted and there's very much that you curate. What you decide to leave in, what you decide to leave out. There are a lot of things I didn't put in this book. And a lot of things I chose to for various reasons. So, but it is just amazing to see these people, having that reaction and really feeling like they're seeing themselves. Because of course you hope that happens, I guess. Otherwise, why write a book? But there's no real guarantee until suddenly it's out there and you honestly have no way of knowing if it's going to strike a nerve with people or what.
I was wondering if you could also dive into some of the misconceptions that you're hoping to tackle here.
Yeah, I guess it's speaking to a little bit like what I talked about before. I feel, it is getting better in terms of media. I mean, but you still see these two. It's a real binary, this narrative that it's either autism's like a superpower or it's a tragedy. And you know, we're just people. We're complex, nuanced people. And I just hope people can start to just see more of a complex figures that we are. So we're not just all the stereotypes that we have in the media. But also, I mean, I would hope, I am not sure this will happen, but I hope that people who really don't know anything about autism will pick up a book like mine and walk in our shoes a little bit, understand what parents go through. There's so much judgment of parents, especially when their children have what they call behaviors. You know, they have meltdowns in public and there's still so much criticism and judgment, you know, looking at parents and particularly mothers like, you know, if you had just done, you know, it's a discipline issue or you've done this wrong or you've done that wrong. So I would love it if people who really don't know much about autism read this book but as opposed to the people who are already going to see themselves. But I mean, both fantastic.
Once again, that was Julie Green, a Kingston author who just released her memoir, Motherness, detailing her experience as an autistic mother raising an autistic child. Motherness is now available at Canadian retailers, including Novel Idea downtown. You can visit Green's website, juliemgreen.ca, to keep up with all of her projects. Before we wrap up this morning, we're going to run through your Friday forecast, a roundup of just some of the events Kingston has to offer this weekend. Starting off today, Friday, October 17th, drop by and visit us at the CFRC Open House in Carruthers Hall, right by the campus bookstore from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. Queen's Homecoming Alumni Welcome and Check-In runs at Grand Hall from 1 to 6 p.m., followed by the JDUC Opening Celebration at 4:30 p.m. Looking to head off campus, Bitchin' Bingo is tonight at Carlo Estates Winery at 6 p.m. And the vinyl record sale continues at the Kingston Symphony Warehouse from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. And don't miss the chills and thrills of Fort Fright at Fort Henry, open nightly at 7 p.m. through all the way to November 1st.
On Saturday, homecoming events continue with check-in at Grant Hall, CFRC's live coverage of the Gales versus Lancers game kicking off at 1 p.m., and the Fall Harvest alumni gathering from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Agnes Benedictson Field. You can also check out local vendors at the Kingston Public Market, the Hocus Pocus and Purpose Festival at the Spire, and the Bomb Retro 80s Live Experience, also at the Spire, at 8 p.m. And wrapping up the weekend on Sunday, stop by the Memorial Center Farmers Market from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. or catch the final day of the vinyl record sale from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast.